Okay, so I'm going to talk about functional connectivity. Actually, this is not my current work now. So as Vera was saying, I'm working on time perception now. But this is something we were doing with Jose and Luis, Jose Luis Perez Velasquez and Luis Garcia Dominguez, since when we were here in Toronto, and then we continue through collaboration thinking about this subject. So the main idea is perhaps it's a bit different from what you have seen today, and the idea is that here we are thinking more on methodological issues. So it's more like what is when you calculate the functional connectivity, is it how much it is true, how much it is the real connectivity that you have in the brain. And I'm talking about experiments, so I'm talking about EEG and MEG, and I said in the title that I will talk about the stochastic approach, and this is true, but I will also talk about non-stochastic approach. So I will try to compare these methods. I don't need this. Oh, yes. So I will not insist on this because it was said in all the talks. I will talk about phase synchronization, and it's just the adjustments of rhythms of weakly coupled oscillators. This is something that you hear today a lot. And the interesting point is that somehow when we talk about functional connectivity, we are going to think about synchronization. And why is that? Well, there are several things to say. And first of all, and you can read this this review, is very nice to read. It's by Varela, 2001. And the main point is that you have two things: synchronization at different scales. I'm talking about temporal and spatial scales. So you have synchronization at the level of neurons, individual neurons. Then you have synchronization in the local field potentials, and then finally you have synchronization, and this affects this gives rise actually to what people measure in evoked potentials, and then finally you have synchronization at very different between very different areas in the brain, so at a large scale. And and the main point is that perhaps this is a way of integrating information in the brain, and this has actually a very interesting cognitive counterpart, and this is what is called a temporal binding problem. And I took this this picture from Engel, 2001. The idea is that binding, I will explain what is binding, is it might be mediated by neural synchronization. Actually, I say might be, but I'm talking about experiments that prove that it's mediated by neural synchronization, at least at the level of neurons. So what is the binding problem in this picture? You have two possibilities. This picture is somehow bistable. So you can either see one face with a candlestick in the middle, or you can see two faces. The point is that there are neurons coding for different aspects of the picture. For example, you might have neurons coding for the eyes or for the shape of the candle. And the idea is that either you have assemblies of neurons synchronized in a way that you see aspects of the face together, so in a way that, for example, this is synchronized with this, and then you see the face, or the other way around. You have synchronization in such a way that you see another picture. So the main idea is that if you have an object, this object is processed in different parts of the brain. So for example, you can have a ball that is red and is round, and the idea is that different parts of the brain are simply working in differently to produce this idea that there is a ball that is red and round at the same time. To achieve that, according to the binding by neural synchrony hypothesis, what is happening is that there are assemblies of synchronized cells that are working together. Now, the problem is that this is not so easy to measure with non-invasive techniques. So it's not the same having an electrode in the brain than measuring from outside with EEG or MEG. And this is the typical situation for cognitive studies, because they are not a pathological population, so you cannot introduce electrodes. So I will distinguish here between two possible approaches. One, this more traditional, is to calculate synchronization from time series in different channels, from EEG or MEG experiment, using, for example, phase locking values or mean phase coherence. I think it is understood that is a correlation between the phases of the signals. This is the traditional approach, but it's somehow indirect, because you are measuring coupling through correlation. So a more direct approach is to assume that there is a model for explaining the signals that you see, mathematical models or some differential equation, and just extract the coupling directly. So some kind of fitting. This is what I will explain. And the question is, what is better to use? So when we were with Jose and Luis, we were studying in epilepsy, we were studying synchronization, and we wondered about the following. If you use electroencephalography, you have a reference electrode, and the question is it possible that just by having a reference electrode, the synchronization that you are measuring is actually distorted? And to study this problem, what we did was actually did an MEG experiment. And why is because in MEG you don't have a reference. So what we did was, here we plotted in the x-axis the synchrony between different channels using MEG, just MEG signals. And in the y-axis, we just decided that one of these channels is a reference, just like this. We say this will be like having EEG. This is the reference. And then we just calculated synchronization between these different channels, just unplotted here. And you can see that here on top, I'm saying how is the strength of this reference electrode. So we see that if the strength of the reference electrode is very small, then it's the same to have a reference electrode or not having a reference electrode. It's just, you can see it's just like a straight line. The synchronization is the same for MEG and for EEG. But as you increase the magnitude of this reference electrode, you see that there is some distortion, and at the end you don't get the same answer. We also proved that analytically, but I think the best way to see it is geometrically. It's very easy. Actually, the idea is that you have in the brain, you have when you measure the signal in your electrodes, you have A, signal A and B. Here I have already done the Hilbert transformer, or whatever you think it was explained in the morning. So now it's a complex signal. And you have these two complex signals, A and B. You have a reference signal. And from the reference signal, you construct the A capital and B capital. These are the two signals. So this would be the simulated EEG signals. So now the question is, imagine that these signals are rotating, but you are they are rotating at the same angular velocity, so they are synchronized. So now you go into a reference system that is rotating at the same angular velocity, and they're just fixed. But imagine that the reference signal is changing in amplitude. You can have something like that. So now the angular velocity is given by these two angles. And as you can see, they are different. So you started with synchronized signals, and you end up with non-synchronized signals. It's very simple. It means that the EEG reference electrode is affecting synchrony measurements. Now, the question is it possible that even in MEG, something like this is happening? So is it just the reference electrode, or is it a more general problem? And then the question was, are synchronization patterns distorted? Is synchronization measure in the source space equal to synchronization measure in the sensor space? And you know probably by now that the answer is no, it's not the same. So the way we prove that, okay, proving is maybe too strong word, but you can notice that this is not the case. And we used epileptiform activity. We observed that during the ictal period, there is a high synchronization pattern. So you can see around every electrode, around this electrode, that there is a high synchronization. So suspiciously, though, if you look at every electrode, you get the same pattern. So maybe this is spurious. So what we did next was simply generate unsynchronized synthetic sources. So just mimic that there are some non-synchronized sources, and pretend that you're measuring the sensor space. And we got exactly the same. So the conclusion is that non-synchronized sources are producing synchronization. So you can go one step further and think that, okay, maybe we should not do that. We have to simply do source reconstruction. So you start with your signals at the sensors, use some kind of algorithm for reconstruction, and then you have some new signals that you know that they are in the source space, and then you calculate synchronization between those signals. But the problem is that they are restricting hypotheses on source statistical properties. Typically, you can do something like ICA, independent component analysis. But as the name says, is trying to extract sources that are independent. So by definition, if they are synchronized, they are not independent. So you have this kind of circular thinking. The idea is that this is a bit abstract. This is not to be taken as I'm just drawing an abstract figure here. It's like you have signals, and I will draw here an angle saying somehow this is the degree of correlation of or synchronization. Then you have a mixing process. This is what is happening here, and you have some new signals. That's what you measure. However, the demixing is trying to put them as orthogonal, so independent or decorrelated. Now question arises is it possible that it's not synchronization is not measurable in principle? And I think the question is no, that it's possible to know what the synchronization is at the sources if you have some idea, some prior knowledge of the correlations between sources. So as you see, the problem is a little bit circular. So perhaps it's better to study the stochastic approach I was talking about in the beginning. So the idea is to estimate the stochastic dynamics from physiological data, so to get to extract the coupling directly instead of trying to extract it from the relationship, the statistic relationship between channels. There are several papers. I will review some of this work, trying to focus on those papers that are more simple and they have the main message. And you can see that there is this paper by Deco, which is very simple because it's one dimension. It's a one-dimensional model. So I will talk about this. Then there are multidimensional models, and I will concentrate on the work by Friedrich with applications in another paper, by Bahram and Assad, which was in the group with Friedrich. But there are other papers that I think that are perhaps more complete in the sense that they are studying connectivity. And these are by Hendricks, two papers by Hendricks, and they're using MEG actually. But I think it's perhaps too much if I go into that. I want you to get the main ideas. So let's start with the paper by Deco, which is a reduced diffusion model. So the idea is that the experiment was very, very simple. You have intracellular recordings in the auditory cortex of anesthetized rats. In this model, you can have light anesthesia or deep anesthesia. And the question is, can we use in this kind of models see the differences between the two possible states? And as I said, it's a one-dimensional diffusion model. So just to see what we are talking about, the hypothesis is that the time series is satisfying a Langevin equation. So it's just a stochastic differential equation describing the movement of an overdamped Brownian particle in a potential. So you see, this is the dynamic, the deterministic part, and then there is some added noise. This is just as Brownian motion, like here. And what you have is the potential. The potential is described by this. It's just the deterministic part, plus you have some noise. The question is, if you decide that your time series are coming from this kind of process, can you extract the parameters of the model? Can you extract the parameters of the equation? And what are the parameters? Are the potential and the diffusion coefficient here and the noise. So the mystic part and the stochastic part. So once the system is described by the Langevin equation, you can think about not about the particular trajectory of so it would be like only one time series, but imagine you have many time series, or so you have a probability distribution. You can do the same for a particle, a Brownian particle, and this is some sort of diffusion term. You have some diffusion term and a drift term. So you describe, I will show you here, you describe as before, you have a particle that is moving here with noise, and now, of course, you have a probability distribution. Dependency, because of diffusion, the tendency is for the particle to spread. So the tendency is for this probability distribution to be flat. But this would be the tendency without the potential. So you have two different forces. One is trying to make to spread the probability distribution. This is the diffusion term. The other is the drift term, so it's trying to move the mean value of the probability distribution. So the stationary solution is actually exponentially. with the normalized potential. It means that if you are here, this is a low state probability state. This is a probability state of low probability. If you are here, it's a state of higher probability. This is logical because the particle is going, tends to go into the minimum of the potential. Of course, this is not a stable state, but a metastable state, because there is noise, so the particle can escape. Not here, because there is only one minima, but if you have several minima, it can go, because of noise, it can jump to different minima. And the idea was to just to, it was just to make some sort of fitting. In this case was to consider that the potential is made of small pieces, each one is quadratic, and simply do fitting with a log likelihood maximization. From there to extract the parameters, these parameters here, and once you have these parameters of the fitting, to get the potential, and also you need to get the diffusion coefficient. How is it obtained? Well, the clever idea in this paper was to use the mean escape time. So, because I didn't say it and I didn't show it, but this system has B stability, so there are two minima, and there is some probability to jump from one minima to the other. The mean escape time is calculated and it's actually inverse proportional to the diffusion coefficient. So this can be calculated from data. And then this is what I'm showing here. In light anesthesia, this is the kind of recordings that you get. This is, remember, sub-threshold membrane potential. And it looks very different to what you get in deep anesthesia. And as you can see, the main difference is that in deep anesthesia, the what is happening is that you have what they are called up and down states. So you can see that here you have some time, the signal is at some level, and then it's going down. So it's going down and then up and so on. It takes some time to go from up to down states. And here is a bit more disorganized. This is not exactly as rat that is not anesthetized, but almost. So you see that there is some transition from non-anesthesia to light anesthesia to deep anesthesia. And then you perform these calculations that I have said before. You just compute a histogram here. From there you get the potential here. And also you have the distribution of durations. So how probable is to have some to stay some time in a given state, minimal state. So how much it is probable to stay, let's say, 2 seconds in this state without jumping. And this is this distribution here. Logically, the probability to be 10 seconds or 20 seconds is too low, it's almost zero. However, you can see that the two potentials are different. And this makes sense because here you see clearly the stability. So that the states are up and down, they're jumping. So it's very obvious, it is clear from the data also. And here the distance is smaller. So because there is noise, the jumps are more frequently. However, and that's what they also found here, is that there is no good fit between simulations and experiment for the distribution of durations. So you can have interesting conclusions from this, because you start by saying that you have a model. This model is deterministic plus noise. But what if this is not what is happening? And this is the case here, because the model didn't work well for deep anesthesia. So it means that it's actually not driven by noise as we thought in the beginning. we don't know what is happening, but perhaps it can be that simply there is some deterministic process. It may be that you don't have one variable but two, so this potential is changing. It's not that the jumps are because of noise, but simply the potential is changing, some sort of bifurcation. However, in the case of light anesthesia, the models work very well, so we can say that this is a good fitting with data. In fact, there are different in the literature you can find that there are different explanations for this kind of phenomena, and perhaps they can coexist by just having one type of dynamics that is not what is presented here, but higher dimensional. In one case, noise is important, in the other case, noise is simply not important. Then it would be interesting to have a higher dimensional version of what we just see. This was only one dimensional. And identically, the idea is to have Langevin equation, that now x is not a single variable, but it's a stochastic vector. Again, you have a deterministic part and a stochastic part. So as before, just as before, but in a higher dimensional space. So the construction, the derivation to find the drift and diffusion coefficients is straightforward. So you have, for example, imagine you have a three-dimensional case, and some you have here in space, you have some curve. This is a trajectory, and the idea is to get a small region, to isolate a small region, and from there you have a point x. So you get all the points that are at the same x. This is changing in time, so this is a time series. So this is t and this is x. You have something like that. And what we are doing here is just isolate some x, say x0, like there, and you have several points passing through the same x. And then you calculate the velocity. Because if you see here, essentially this is, g is essentially a velocity. So to calculate the drift coefficient is simply to calculate the velocity. And by velocity we mean that if you are here, you have to find inside some temporal interval tau, you have to find all the points that go from here to here. So you are at x, and then you have to construct the distribution of x bar, which is some Gaussian distribution. So all the points after some time t, tau, sorry. And then this is done here. And then you have to take the limit of tau go to zero, and you get the drift coefficient. For the diffusion coefficient, simply you do the same, but for the spread of this x bar. So somehow you have to find the standard deviation. It's done here. So with this in mind, let's see some application. Again, it's a very similar experiment. It's anesthetized rats. Again, we have deep anesthesia and light anesthesia. There are different states, the up and down states, and those that of light anesthesia, they are not so obvious. And but you will see that the nice point here is that there are different flavors for these models. You can do different things. For example, here you can what they did was to find the coupling between different frequencies. You could have decided to find the coupling between different channels, but instead a more interesting question was to find the coupling between delta and theta bands in each EEG bands. from 0.5 to 3.5 for theta, and from 3.5 to 7.5 for the opposite. So the model accounts for the interaction between delta and theta bands. So going back to the same notation, now Q is a vector, is just delta and theta bands. You simply have to filter your signal, and one filter at one frequency, another filter at a different frequency, you have two signals. So now you have two equations. As before, you have drift and diffusion. Pay attention, because now also there is no coupling, no deterministic coupling between in the hypothesis, so in the model, there is no deterministic coupling between the two different frequencies, only in the diffusion coefficient. You can do whatever you like, so why not? So preliminary, you can integrate out one of the variables and calculate the drift and the diffusion coefficients. Here are for D for deep anesthesia, L for light anesthesia, so you have a straight line for the drift. The drift there. And you have something more complicated, like a potential that is quadratic or quartic, so you can also find the fourth order in the Kramers-Moyal expansion, and so on. But it's more interesting to have both variables, the interplay between both variables, so not integrating out. And what you can see is that if you look at the drift and diffusion coefficients for the delta, you see that they both depend on theta and delta oscillations or band. So there is a dependence on both bands. But if you look at the coefficients in theta, you see that they don't depend on delta. So the conclusion is that the EG theta component influences the delta component, but not vice versa. So you can see that from here, you can get some interesting physiological conclusions. And this work is very simple, but can be extended, can be done in several dimensions. So you can have you can do a EEG or MEG experiment, have consider a signal for every channel, and calculate the different couplings. Now I would like to introduce a physical analogy because it's interesting, and the idea is that you have some kind of Gedanken experiment or ideal experiment that I don't know if it's possible to do. Where you have some cylinder with gas and some device to measure the microscopic variables of the molecules inside the gas. For one experiment is A, he managed to measure the microscopic variables, P and Q, for every molecule. For B, unfortunately, he doesn't measure P and Q directly, but linearly transform, there is some transformation, a linear transformation. So the question is, if this experimenter is faced with this data that is linearly transformed, and this is what happened in the brain, is he or she able to find the correct coupling between the molecules? Also, is he or she able to find the macroscopic equations? Are they the same? Are they the same equations? And by macroscopic, why is that I say macroscopic is because in a typical experiment, for example, ERP experiment, you find you don't look at the individual traces, but you do a mean value. You take a mean value. And this is equivalent to having the here to having the pressure or temperature and so on. So is the analogy, although not perfect, is there. And the answer is that no, it will be distorted because, for example, you have in phase space, you have the blue here is the non-transformed variable. So you have, of course, a constant velocity. But if you transform if you have a linear transformation, you get something like that. So you see that the velocity depends on, there is some dependence of the velocity with the coordinates of different particles. This is a very simplified picture. Imagine this is multidimensional. If you look at that, then you conclude that, in this case, you conclude the law of ideal gases. In the other case, not. So macroscopic laws are changed. But also, you conclude that the coupling is not the same. Of course, because you see that there is some coupling. The coupling was artificially introduced by the linear transformation. This can be seen from the Langevin approach, because you have somehow interacting channels, an interaction that was artificially introduced by this transformation. So here, the drift and diffusion coefficients change, and therefore the coupling have changed. The conclusion is that the same kind of problems that you have when you measure connectivity by using statistical relationship between channels are present here is the same type of problem. It's like the fact that you have signal superposition, and this cannot be eliminated, and it appears into the equations of motion. And therefore, I want to conclude. I would say some positive words about the stochastic approach. So first, that the functional connectivity calculated in sensor space is not equal to connectivity calculated in source space. So what you calculate in an experiment is not what is there, is really there. The first type of approach is also restricted because there is an indirect calculation of coupling via a statistical correlation. So it's not what you really have. Approaches based on stochastic dynamics are more refined because they allow for a direct calculation of coupling. However, this approach offers from the same problem, the signal superposition curve, as much as the previous method. And moreover, I want to say a word of caution that imagine that you decide that what you want to know is the relationship between macroscopic, let's call it like the macroscopic variables, which are means of what you measure. So means of, let's say, EEG. Let's say you want to, you decide that there is a relationship between MEG and EEG means. So what you will get, if you get an equation, it will not be necessarily what is there really in the brain. So because even macroscopic laws could be distorted by signal superposition. Okay, thank you. I don't know if I was too fast.